Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Reading, narrative, and the self.
What do we want to talk about when we talk about selves? Surely there's got to be some artistry in this story.
Each of us writes at least one novel, the story of our own lives.
The telling of our stories allows us to tell a story of our future, which allows us to plan, but it also allows us to enjoy our lives, to be aesthetic appreciators.
Does a life need a narrative?
Or is life just one damn thing after another?
There's an additional value conferred upon a life by its having a certain kind of shape.
Our guest is Joshua Landy, co-director of the Literature and Philosophy Initiative at Stanford University.
The story of a life that builds from stupid things that you did to slightly less stupid things is a more satisfying story.
Reading, narrative, and the self.
Recorded in front of a live audience of friends of the San Francisco Public Library.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're in front of a live audience at the Congregation Beth Shalom in San Francisco, recording the program with the Friends of the San Francisco Public Library.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, reading, narrative, and the self.
Well, Ken, that's a mouthful. I mean, reading is something most people do. A good narrative or story, to use a less fancy term, is something most people enjoy. And a self is something everyone has. But when you put them all together, reading, narrative, and the self, what are we getting at?
Well, let's take them in reverse order. Let's start with the self. I mean, you're right. Everybody has a self, or maybe it's better to say everybody is a self. But here's a question. What exactly is a self anyway?
Well, you know, it depends on who you talk to. Psychologists think of the self in terms of the attributes of a person, the most important attributes of a person to the person, the attributes a person has that that person most strongly identifies with. So for you, being from Ohio, your part of yourself is being an Ohioan. For me, being an aesthete and an intellectual
well, there you
is,
go.
Is part of myself.
Well, that's how psychologists tend to think of themselves. Philosophers, on the other hand, don't think of that particular bundle of attributes as the self, but more the underlying agent or thinker who possesses the kind of attributes that define the self in this psychological sense.
So, good point. Two conceptions of the self. Which one are we concerned with today?
Well, both, really.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, the thing about human beings is that the self, in the psychologist sense, is not just given to us in advance as something fixed and determinate. That self has to be constructed, and it's constructed out of materials that our society or our culture that they make available.
Well, but I mean, the self is, I'm not a social construct. Myself is a social construct. It could exist without society or culture.
Well, I wasn't really I was talking about self in the psychologist sense. I agree with you that the self in the philosopher's sense, the thing that underlies the psychologist's self, that definitely isn't. I don't think that's a social construction at all. In fact, I think the self in the philosopher's sense is the thing that does the constructing of the self in the psychologist's sense. It's not the thing that gets constructed, it's the constructor.
So like Merle Kessler's the self in the philosopher's sense, and Ian Scholes is a self in the psychologist sense because Merle constructed Ian Scholes.
Well, that's kind of right.
Yeah, getting closer, yes.
Yeah.
So I'm here constructing myself, right?
It sounds
vaguely sinful. I see where we're going with this. I even see how it ties into the topic of narrative.
Well, how so?
Well, narrative helps us to make sense of ourselves. If we're going to construct a self, we need a storyline. One way we understand ourselves is by narrating ourselves, telling ourselves stories in which we figure as prominent characters. Think of a son who inherits the family business. This doesn't see himself as a kind of a single little individual. He sees himself as a great drama and trying to make sense of his life, his choices, his situation. He sees his life as an episode in a drama that stretches back over multiple generations.
Well, I think that's right. But you know, the stories that we tell ourselves, they're not just about relating the present to the past. They also look to the future. They help us shape our choices and decisions because we try to make our narratives true by trying to become what we've told ourselves that we are.
Sounds kind of dangerous, like we're going to end up being prisoners of the stories we told ourselves a while back, or even worse, ones we inherited from our family or our culture.
I don't mean to suggest that. I mean, because we do have the freedom to reject the narratives that our society or culture or families offer up. But, you know, we can't make sense of ourselves, or even, I don't think we can even plan for the future without some background narrative in place. I mean, we don't really have a choice about that. That's just part of the human predicament.
So now I kind of see where the third thing on our list, reading, is going to fit in. Great works of literature are rich storehouses of narrative possibilities. In real life, we only get one time through. We get one chance to narratively construct a self. But the great works of literature can expose us to thousands of experiments in narrative self-construction.
Well, that's exactly right. So who better to help us with this grand trio of topics, reading, narrative, and the self, who better than someone steeped in the theory of literary narratives?
And luckily, although he was lost for some time, we did finally track down Joshua Landy from Stanford University in a dusty corner of the Stanford Library covered with books and mumbling to himself. He'll join us in a little bit.
And we want our audience, who as friends of the San Francisco Public Library are undoubtedly avid readers, and no doubt they're also highly practiced at self-narration. We want their help too.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Angela Kilduff, takes a closer look at the role of the library in our self-narration. She files this report.
We go to libraries for different reasons, but fiction can really capture the imagination. To find out which fictional characters people really love, I visited the San Francisco Public Library.
Just pick one of my favorites. Gandalf the Wizard from Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Perhaps one of my favorite characters is Andrei Bolkonsky. He's a protagonist from Tolstoy's novel, The War and Peace. He just represents a very balanced, very healthy individual.
My favorite fictional character is Tom Sawyer because he was so innovative and he was such an adventurer.
One of my favorite characters is Don Quixote from Miguel de Cervantes, and it's because Don Quixote was a dreamer, and in many ways I read books that take me away and as an escape, as therapy.
The last voice we heard was Luis Herrera, San Francisco's city librarian. He's responsible for overseeing the city's main library and 27 branches.
Another one that's similar to the concept of dreaming is The Secret Garden. The character there, little Mary Lennox, uses Secret Garden as an escape. I love those kind of characters that transport you to other places. The flip side of that is I also like books that are didactic, that teach you about character, the good and the bad.
Herrera loves books, but says libraries are much more than collections of bound volumes.
I see libraries as kind of the most democratic institution where you really are looking at sharing information and providing information. So books are part of that, but it's broader than that. As far as I'm concerned, the role of libraries is really about having a very aware and well-informed society.
As city librarian, it's his job to meet the needs of an incredibly diverse community.
We have materials in over 65 languages to reflect a very, very different, diverse user group. Also, whether it's the Chinese community, the Spanish-speaking community, Russian community, Vietnamese, I can go on and on. And to me, that's very much part of a cultural narrative that we're sort of weaving for the city, because people want to be reflected and represented within a city's cultural story.
Technology has extended the library's reach, but Herrera says it hasn't made the library any less relevant. If anything, the libraries are now more critical.
We have a digital divide, and the public library is a great equalizer because it definitely provides access to those that do not have it. We started a laptop lending program about a year ago, and it's actually one of our more popular checkout materials. You check out a laptop to use in your neighborhood library, just like you would check out a book, and that's the number one circulating item.
Laptops are important tools, but the city librarian insists the printed page isn't going away anytime soon.
We still had almost 12 million items borrowed this last year. And the majority of those are still books.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Angela Kilduff.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Congregation Beth Shalom in San Francisco.
And we're joined now by Joshua Landy. He's a professor of French and Italian at Stanford University, where he's also co-director of the Literature and Philosophy Initiative. Josh, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Josh, you're co-director of the Literature and Philosophy Initiative, whatever that might be. Tell us briefly what it is, why there should be such a thing, and what motivates you to co-direct it.
Well, John, it's an opportunity for me to climb out from under that stack of books that's usually on my head in that dusty corner of the library and come and talk to you guys.
Another dusty corner of the campus.
Yeah, another dusty corner of the campus.
Yeah, but why philosophy and literature? That's what I want to know.
Look, I mean, I couldn't have said it any better than you guys did in your introduction. It's this kind of conversation that I think many of us want to be having. I'm not saying the two of you should be having it all the time, or should we want to be having it all the time, but there are rich intellectual avenues here, having to do with, for example, the relationship between narrative and the self. And these things, I think, are best done between conjunction between experts in philosophy and experts in literary criticism.
So let's get to the topic of narrative. What exactly is a narrative? How is a narrative different from, say, a scientific explanation or just a bare chronicle?
Are you assuming that a narrative has to be an explanation?
Well, I don't know. Isn't it?
We're asking you, dude. What is a narrative?
I'd say, I ask you for a narrative. Say, how did you get to be co-director of literature and philosophy? Now, when you gave me a narrative, wasn't it an explanation? But it wasn't a scientific explanation.
I think I gave you an explanation which wasn't a narrative. But we can debate that later. What's a narrative? I mean, so a minimal definition of a narrative is state one, change state two. And usually the change has to be done by some agent or plurality of agents.
The dog barks.
Well, the dog barks, I silence the dog. The dog is no longer barking. Okay. That's a little narrative.
Hmm. So what are the defining features of a narrative?
Well, so, you have to have a beginning state, an end state, and a change that's affected by agents. Usually it's a little more interesting.
A beginning, an end, and a change that's affected by agents.
So it's important that there be agents involved.
Yes.
Right. So a narrative is about knitting together what we philosophers call intentional actions, things we do intentionally on purpose is that right?
Yeah. If human beings aren't involved, usually we don't call it, if the apple was on the table, it fell off. We usually wouldn't refer to as a narrative.
Psychologists try to explain human behavior. Psychologists try to explain human behavior. They look for kind of like laws or something. You know, the laws of psychology. Is that narrative? How is that different? How is what the psychologists do different from what you literary types do?
It's an extremely important distinction. On the one hand, and this comes back to what you were saying in your introduction, what do we want to talk about when we talk about selves? On the one hand, you want to talk about narratives, but on the other, you want to talk about non-narrative features, your great laugh and your great voice, which are things that presumably stay with you throughout your life.
So take a novel like Moby Dick. There's a series of events depicted in the novel. Is that the narrative, or is the narrative what the reader or the critic brings to that or gets out of that?
I want you to hold that question and think about it so you can give John a devastatingly deep answer. This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from Congregation Beth Shalom in San Francisco with an audience of friends of the San Francisco Public Library. We're discussing reading, narrative, and the self with Joshua Landy from Stanford University.
In our next segment, we'll explore the connections between narrative and personal identity. How do the stories we tell ourselves shape who we really are in the world? How do they impact our future choices and decisions? Are we prisoners of the stories we self-narrate? Or do they give us freedom to reshape our lives?
Narrating our many selves, plus questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
One day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm going to do it again, yes sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and we're discussing Reading a Narrative in the Self with Joshua Landy from Stanford University.
How do the stories we tell ourselves about our past and present impact the future choices and decisions we make? Are we trapped by the stories we tell ourselves, or can we reshape our lives by reshaping our narratives? As we close the last segment, I had just asked Josh, exactly what is a narrative? Take Moby Dick, you have a series of events. Is that the narrative, or is it something additional on top that we get out of Ishmael or somebody?
It's something on top.
Okay.
Somebody famously said, although it's always attributed to different people, history is just one damn thing after another. And that's...
Hume said that.
Well, if you like.
Yeah.
I believe Obama said it.
No doubt. Whereas, if we want to appeal to a richer definition of narrative, it's got to be something more than that. There's something more in Moby Dick than just a sequence of events. And that's a coordination between those events.
A coordination? What kind of coordination?
Well, you can have different types. The simplest type would be a causal chain. So take, we'll change the example from Moby Dick to Oedipus the king, if you don't mind.
No problem at all.
Oedipus is told that he's going to kill his father, therefore he leaves home, therefore he happens to be in the same place as this elderly gentleman who so happens to resemble him, you know, and hilarity ensues, right? So that's an example of a causal chain in a narrative. But that's just one example.
Well, so that's a that's narrative in a literary form, right? And I think there are various narrative forms and genres and all that stuff. But the narrative of a human life, I think that's something different. I think it's not just intentional actions knitted together. What is the knitting? It's the knitting together by reasons, by things that tell us not just what I have done, but the meaning, the significance of what I have done, and not just what I intend to do, but give me a reason why I intend to do it as part of some unfolding story of my life that in some sense governs my life. So it has what philosophers like to call normative significance. So I think we narrate our lives in what I like to call normatively laden terms, because narrative is kind of theater of meaning
but
and significance.
That's frightening. That sounds like there's a destiny, and I'm supposed to reinterpret my life as seeing each piece leading to this destiny. That's weird.
No, it's not weird. Remember the son who inherited the family business, who narrated his life as an episode in a continuing drama of which he was only a small part? That drama puts demands on him. So I owe it to my family heritage to keep this thing afloat. It would be a betrayal. It would be a letting down, or he can reject it. We say it would be escaping. It would be freedom.
I think you're putting too much emphasis on the past part of the narrative.
Well, that's only just an illustration. But why do you say that?
Well, because even if we ignore the past, even if I say, well, so what? I inherited this company. Boo to that company. I'm going to become a rodeo clown.
Well, that's true.
Nonetheless, I'm still going to need narrative skills. Why? Because I need to tell the story of my future to myself.
I agree. Right? I tell myself what I am and try to make myself become it, as it were. I'm going to be a rodeo clown, so I try to become a rodeo clown. I try to make it true. Right? Of course, I could. Now, this leads to another question, though. I try to make it true that I'm a rodeo clown. Maybe I'm utterly failed at it. And everybody else sees that I'm utterly failed at it. But I set out to be a rodeo clown.
And then they finally convince you. Your gift is philosophy.
Yeah. So look, here's a question. You know, some stories I tell myself are just simply false, bad faith. Who am I? Am I the false stories I tell myself, or am I the false stories that other people tell of me? Am I the true? I mean, which one? Does a false one do just as well as a true one, or what?
You're asking.
Is it only my telling that matters?
You're asking multiple questions at once.
I
Ken.
Know that's a sin, but
let me try to
pick
answer
the one you want.
I'm going to pick one.
Yeah, pick one.
I think it does matter that your story should be reasonably faithful to what's actually going on in your life, and I think one test for it would be, if I tell this story to somebody else, are they going to agree this is the right way?
Well, what somebody else? I mean, look, I'm a slaveholder, and I'm the slave. I tell this story to the slaveholder that he's oppressing me and unjustly imprisoning me.
No, I'm talking about the ideal reader, right? So I tell my story to the ideal reader who's not partial to me, right? Who's not just going to listen in an excessively charitable way. Will that person buy it, right? Well, so I'll say, yes, I'm really a rodeo clown. Well, I've never been to a rodeo, and I'm not a clown. I don't have large shoes. That person's not going to accept it.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so there have to be some constraints. At the same time, surely there's got to be some artistry in this story. So I'm imagining that a certain amount of honesty and a certain amount of artistry are going to be mutually regulating ideals in this story.
I'm going to remind our listeners that they're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about reading narrative in the self with Joshua Landy from Stanford University in front of a live audience of friends of the San Francisco Public Library, and we'd love to have questions from that live audience. So if you have a question, come up to the microphone and tell us your name and where you're from and give us your question. But you were about to say
something. No, I'm about to say something. I think you guys are both missing the point. I mean, narrative is a good thing in a novel because novels are supposed to be fun to read. I think narrative's terrible in history. I mean, it's nice in popular history because it gives you something to read, but history is one damn thing after another, and that's what they should tell you. And your life is one damn thing after another. And if you're sitting around thinking, you know, this has all its significance and so forth and so on. I mean, I had a cousin that went bankrupt with our family lumberyard a few years ago, and it was bad enough to go bankrupt, but to go bankrupt and think, ah, this is the culmination of seven generations of Perry selling lumber to people who can't afford it, you know.
But look, I think you inadvertently made a great point.
That's usually how those great points go.
That's my life's narrative.
Novels are supposed to be fun to read. Well, what I want to suggest is lives should be too. Oscar Wilde had this famous line, I always bring my diary on the train, one should always have something sensational to read on the train. obviously, this is a Wildean exaggeration, but we all want to have sensational things to tell ourselves. This is why we take photographs.
Didn't you ever hear of living in the moment? Right? Photographs are exactly the sickness that befalls us. People kind of go to the beach, and instead of enjoying the beach, taking pictures of the beach so they can look at the pictures of the beach some other time when there's some other place that they could be enjoying instead of looking at the pictures. This is all just sickness unto death.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about reading narrative in the self in front of a live audience at the Congregation Beth Shalom with friends of the San Francisco Public Library. We'd love to have questions from that live audience. Come up to the microphones and stand in the queue, and we've got a questioner now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man. Tell us your name and where you're from and what your question is.
So my name is Kristen. I'm from Chicago. And so this goes back to what you were talking about a little while ago, and Ken, you were talking a lot about the stories that we tell ourselves, the story about the rodeo clown, and I was wondering, so some people are better at telling stories than others, and so some people are wonderful storytellers. So how do those stories that those people tell relate to the stories that we tell ourselves as we're living our lives?
You got that, Josh?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for the question.
I think that among those people who are great storytellers are people like the great literary writers that Ken and John were talking about earlier. And one of the reasons that we read those great works like Moby Dick and Oedipus the King and so on is to get better at telling our own stories, right? So we learn what stories are like in order that we can tell our stories. And the telling of our stories allows us to tell a story of our future, which allows us to plan. But it also allows us, I think, contra John, it also allows us to enjoy our lives, to be aesthetic appreciators of everything that we've experienced.
I want to put pressure on you from a different direction. John wants to reject narration. He thinks one darn thing after another, that's just the way it is, right? And the knitting together can be, I don't know, confabulation, a burden. I agree with that. But now, here's the thing. In telling my story of me, I have to tell the story of you. Because I have to say, what are you doing in my life? You know, you're like a prop in my self-narration. And I'm like a prop in your self-narration. And all these things are contested and we push back and forth. I mean, do I really get to tell my own story? Is that really, you know, is it just a matter of I tell myself whatever story seems right? How's that work? How does this social thing work?
In a very complicated way. Do you want me to go on?
Yes, I'd like to go on.
How long an answer do you want?
This is radio.
Let me give you one example.
Longer than what you just gave me, but shorter than the segment.
Take Primo Levi. Primo Levi is a guy who's best known for writing about his experiences in Auschwitz. But after writing those experiences in a set of memoirs, he wrote a book called The Periodic Table, which is also a memoir of his life, but it's structured, each chapter is focused around a chemical element. What is this book? This book is a resistance to the kind of story that's told about him.
Yeah.
To a narrativizing of his life, to a reduction of his life to this is the guy who went through that experience. And what he's saying is, no, I'm reclaiming my life. for non-narrative features. I have this important non-narrative feature of my personality. I'm a chemist. I see everything through the prism of the periodic table. That's how I see myself. I resist your attempt not only to tell your version of my story, but even to tell my life
as a
story.
Do you think we have a special entitlement to tell our own stories and not to have our stories told by others? Is that like autonomy? Autonomy is the right of self-narration.
I think that would be one version of autonomy, yeah.
We've got another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sarah. Tell us your name and your question and where you're from. And
my name's Joe Murphy. I'm from Mountain View, California. My question is, does a narrative change nature when it's written down?
That's a good question for you, Josh. You're the expert in narrative.
Does a narrative change nature when it's written down? Well, there are certain things you can do more easily in written narratives than you can do in oral narrations. For one thing, you can have the reader flip back. In oral narration, if you forget, you're done. So my favorite novel is Proust's In Search of Lost Time, which is a mere 4,000 pages. Read it tomorrow. That's a novel that depends heavily not on your memory, but on your willingness to keep flipping back and checking. Now, how does that connect to lives? Well, arguably, it's a reason to keep a diary. Another way to introduce.
So, John, I wonder if you're becoming more convinced, or are you still skeptical about the centrality and importance of narrative? I mean, Josh and I were kind of agreeing. Autonomy is the right to self-narrate?
No, I'm so very skeptical. I think narrative makes bad history and you know, maybe not always. It's fine for biography. You're going to sell it. You want people to read it. Invent some narrative for your life. Makes it interesting. But what your life is and what history is one thing after another. Let me give you an example. For some reason, I've been reading a lot about the War of 1812. Now, the War of 1812 is America lost that war. Most people in America don't know that. I believe the Canadians are quite clear about it. And it was just one damn thing after another. Idiot congressman thinks the people in Canada want to join the U.S., but he's wrong. Idiot congressman thinks that the British, the most powerful navy in the world, will quit impressing our seamen if we tell them in loud enough terms. Non-idiot, but not very courageous president refuses to veto the act of war. Capital gets burned down. We sue for peace. We don't get anything. Now, then there's this narrative. Oh, the glorious war that gave America its identity, not to mention the Star Spangled Banner, which nobody can sing, right? And it's just falsification and wrong.
So look, I want to agree with you about something. So grand
the War of 1812.
No, I want to agree with you about
the
grand historical narratives. Look, there is the Christian narrative of history guided by a providential God. Okay, God goes away in many places in the Western world, and things like Marxism comes along, and there's this narrative of the history of the proletariat throwing off the ruling class, and there's the narrative of capitalist triumph, and there are all these grand historical narratives that mostly elites tell each other about how they deserve the place. I grant you that most of that is self-serving, obfuscation crap. I grant you that. But that's different from, I think, the utter necessity that every individual human being has of asking and answering what I call the who am I question and what shall I be question. It just comes with the turf. Your life is not given something as fixed and determinate. It's given in something that you have to construct. And I think you narratively construct it. And I do believe this capacity for narration runs amok when we try to narrate the whole course of human history.
I'll meet you guys halfway. Let's construct narratives, but not these long things. Like, be more like skits. You know, my life as a series of Saturday Night Live skits. I could get behind that.
That's what Nietzsche calls brief habits. But we've got another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Sarah from San Francisco, and I was wondering what happens to the person who writes down their narrative in an autobiography, a diary, and then through the passage of time realizes that they think about that situation differently and wants to change it.
So it's kind of like a rough draft, and you want to correct it or something.
And I think probably we all do versions of that all the time, even if we're not writing them down. Rousseau, of course, was famous for doing this kind of thing. I think at that point you then have to think about that writing as another thing in your life that you now have to account for. So I don't think your stories constrain you. You're not trapped in the way that John.
Well, but it does raise another issue. We don't have privileged access, as philosophers like to say, to the true story of our lives. We can think, this is the story of my life, and we can reflect and say, oh my God, that's not what my life was at all. I mean, do you agree with that?
I agree, but that's not a reason to abandon having some kind of framework to one's life. In fact, it might be impossible to abandon it altogether.
We got another questioner from our live audience. Ma'am, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Tell us your name and where you're from and tell us your question.
I'm Christy Pekikoro from Rochester, New York. And my question dovetails with the last one. What are some of the dangers of narrative? If indeed you did write in a diary at some point, like I used to do when I was a child, and you go back and you read some of the horrifying things that you did and why you did them, what kind of dangerous effects can this have on a person that would discourage one from engaging in that kind of self-narrative?
Well, you could get your diary stolen, for one thing.
By my brother.
I mean, so... what I want to say is, first of all, it's very important to realize that narrative is not everything. And the Primo Levi case shows that very powerfully. Narrative isn't everything. The story I tell about the concatenation of events isn't everything. There's something about me that goes beyond that. But I also still want to say there's something beautiful about rereading your old diary where you did those incredibly stupid things. Why? Because the story of a life that built from stupid things that you did to slightly less stupid things, at least in my case, maybe in your case, brilliant things that you're doing, is a more satisfying story than a story in which you started off perfect and you remain perfect through your whole life.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing reading narrative in the self with Joshua Landy from Stanford University.
In our final segment, we're going to take up the issue of reading. Great works of literature offer us thousands of experiments in narrative self-construction. Can we learn anything from reading them that applies to our real-world selves?
We're coming to you from the Congregation Beth Shalom in San Francisco with an audience of friends of the San Francisco Public Library. We'll take more questions and comments when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing reading a narrative in the self with Joshua Landy, co-director of the Literature and Philosophy Initiative at Stanford University. So we've got more questions from our live audience. Sir, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Tell us your name and your question and where you're from.
My name's Ernie. I'm from Montreal, Canada.
Ah, welcome.
Number of the questioners brought up the word of diaries. Many people write diaries throughout their life, and then their last wish is that the diary be burned. Is there anything we should read into that?
Well, look, I mean, I think one thing we should read into it is that there's a big difference between telling your story for yourself and telling your story for other people. And I'm mostly interested in the first. It's true that the point that John made earlier is true. You know, people can construct all kinds of narratives for the sake of some kind of political effect or something like that. And these are generally to be regarded with suspicion. But if you're writing your diary and it's just for you, and it's so much just for you that you want it burned at the end of your life, well, that shows you that, in fact, the reason you want your story is just for your own personal satisfaction. You want to enjoy your life. You want to be like Oscar Wilde, who finds your life sensational when you read it on the train.
I think that's right. But I still think there's an essential publicness in the following way. Because you are in the world, and the question always will be put to you, what are you doing here? Right, and you have to present yourself, and you have to present. You can present yourself in terms of the others providing. You can do that, or you can present yourself in terms of your own providing. And there's I think that human life is partly a contest over in whose terms shall this event be narrated. In whose terms shall my life be narrated? Do I get to decide the terms? Does somebody else? So you can tell your story just for yourself, but there's always still this thing. People asking you, well, what's your story, dude, that justifies your being here, that makes you not just...
But I think you're talking about two things. I think, you know, what's your story, dude, doesn't actually really mean give me a story.
It does.
What it means is, what do you hold most valuable? What would count for you as a great achievement? Well, and that doesn't need a story.
Well, wait. holding, I think, again, I think our narratives are normatively laden terms. They use some heavy philosophical ease, yeah. Right? So it's always about value. What do you value? What are you trying to achieve? What are your reasons? It's always about that stuff. I agree about that, but I still think, maybe we use narrative in different, maybe we're not using narrative in the same way. I don't just mean the story with a beginning, middle, and an end. I mean the story that knits together a structure of reasons and justifications and projects and aims that in some way normatively govern what you are trying to become. So I mean something heavier.
I love the idea of doing that knitting, and I think that doing that knitting can allow you to pick your story. So it can have a downstream consequence in narrative. If I decide, for example, that the thing I care most about is curing cancer, then I can tell myself a future-oriented life story about that.
Right.
It's a kind of a quest narrative.
Right.
If, on the other hand, what I care the most about is becoming a certain kind of person and a kind of enrichment of the soul or something like that, I'm going to tell myself another kind of narrative, more like a Bildungsroman.
Oh, you're using literary terms. So there are literary...
You brought me on as the literary person.
Do you think our lives are structured around literary genres? Huh? I mean, there's a fixed set of literary genres, and you think our lives are kind of fit into those literary genres?
I think we can usefully borrow from them. I'm not saying that our lives neatly fit, or anybody's life neatly fits, but I think we can usefully borrow. Here's an example. Yeats had this lovely line. He says, "Being Irish, I have an abiding sense of tragedy, which sustains me through temporary periods of joy." So we can usefully borrow from literary genres to sustain us through temporary periods of joy.
But let me take two lives, one of which lends itself to a nice narrative with a beginning, middle, and end. It's all knit together with normatively and all that stuff. The other one is just a life kind of like mine where, you know, you just go along, a series of skits. I want to be a football player, so I'll go to this college. Well, I'm not a football player. But here's a philosophy class, so I'll take that. Whoops, now I'm married. What do I do for a living? Oh, here's a fellowship. I better take that. Right? Nothing knits it together except one thing happening after another. Now, is that kind of life intrinsically less valuable, likely to be less happy, less noble, less interesting, do less good for the world,
yes,
than one that happens to lend itself to one of your little narratives?
Wait a minute. Is there a literary genre for Jean's life? What is the
literary genre? It's a picaresque. I don't know if it's a great picaresque. No, I'm just joking. Look, you could do...
I would reply to you if I had any idea what a picaresque is.
It's your life, one thing after another.
No to some of those. I mean, you could do just as much good and so on. But would it be as valuable? I want to say no. I want to say not that your life be devoid of value. Of course not. But there's an additional value conferred upon a life by its having a certain kind of shape that's over and above all of the individual satisfactions that you get and all of the additional good that you do in the world. And your life, sorry, if it's really true that you really think of it that way, might be deprived of that additional value.
Well, that's one last question in here. We've got, welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
I'm David from San Francisco, and I'm a musician. I'd be curious to find out what you have to say about the topics that you've had so far extended to lyrics and songwriting, the words, the stories told with music.
I think music can be just as powerful an inspiration for this kind of self-fashioning that we've been talking about today as literature, in both dimensions, both in the across time dimension and in the within a moment dimension. Because what does music do? It creates structures. It creates powerfully emotive and beautiful structures. And these are structures I think we can borrow from those forms.
Right.
And bring them into our life.
I think I've learned something. I've known you for a long time. We've taught together, and I must have known this already. But I now realize something about you. You really think that among the highest values by which we should live are aesthetic values. That a great command on a life, is make your life beautiful, a work of art. I mean, we teach this course together at Stanford called The Art of Living, and you really mean that, don't you?
You didn't think I was serious. I want to go overboard here. Of course, other values are incredibly important, and in many cases, more important, right? So it's not as though if you had the choice between curing cancer and making your life beautiful, you would necessarily choose making your life beautiful. I'm not saying that at all.
Thank you.
What I'm saying is just that there's an additional value to be had, and I think we sometimes forget that. So yes to aesthetic, the aesthetic is an important source of values in a life.
But how do I separate? I think my wife is a good person, a luminously good person.
And she's now, and she's a librarian. In a way.
Yeah, and she's also a librarian, that's true. But now, how do I separate out my assessment of her kindness, her moral goodness, her all that from, is beauty of a life separate from all those other, I don't understand exactly. I mean, I understand literary beauty, right? As a separate thing, distinct from morality and all these other virtues that one might have. But I don't know if I understand the beauty of a life separate from a whole collection of virtues and values that are not aesthetic.
Well, let me give you a cheap example. My brother currently works as an investment banker. When we were kids, we used to play Monopoly together, and he would be the banker, and he would steal money.
I wonder where this is going.
There's a narrative.
There's a narrative, right? Yes. But I'm not claiming there's some causal relation between those things. I'm not saying because he used to steal money as the banker in Monopoly, he became an investment banker, a good one, an honest one, by the way. What I'm saying is there's something delightful about that. There's something very pleasing about that. And so in the case of a love story, those kinds of delightful coincidences and connections abound. And I'm sure you could find plenty if you thought back.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there are things in which one may take delight, but a delightful life, I would say, is a morally good life spent in the service of things worthy of a human being to do and done wholeheartedly. And I don't think of that as aesthetic in the sense of a delightful novel, which you could have a novel about the most wicked of lives that would be aesthetically beautiful.
And conversely, you can have a novel about a moral life that would be supremely boring. But let me give you another example. Prodigal Son. Prodigal Son is a very weird parable because it seems to suggest that it's worse to live a life in which you're consistently good throughout. It's better to live a life in which you start out kind of bad and then get good. So even from a very moral standpoint, there seems to be creeping in around the edges this idea that, well, there's a specifically aesthetic value that can make your life better.
So one of the things you want from literature is not just models of admirable lives, right? But literature there's a certain dimension in which we value literature, an aesthetic dimension.
Exactly.
And you want our lives to embody that same aesthetic. And that's part of your interest. That's why you're not interested so much in characters, but you're interested in genres and the narrative possibilities of genres, because these are things of beauty. So you want
to get back
lives be things of beauty.
Exactly.
Of aesthetic beauty.
That's right. I mean, to go back to your original question about what narrative is and Moby Dick, what I'm interested in are the specific things that literary narratives specialize in, specific devices for knitting things together.
Is Ahab's life a thing of beauty?
But again, it's not about the character. It's about the arc of the novel as a whole.
No, I'm not talking about the novel. I'm saying if there was a guy named Ahab that just actually that was a true story of his life, it must be a really aesthetically neat life because it fit into the best novel that America's produced, except maybe for Huckleberry Finn, in my humble opinion. But it looks to me like a miserable life.
Just because it is in a beautiful novel doesn't mean it's necessarily a beautiful life. What the novelist is doing is deploying these specifically literary devices that generate beauty. And in fact, that's one of the great things about literature, is it very frequently takes things that are grim and unpleasant and beautifies them and transfigures them in the light of the aesthetic.
But I'm like a character, not like the novel. So Ahab is a possible person. Moby Dick is a possible universe, but I am more like Ahab, not like the novel.
In your introduction, you seem to be suggesting you're both. I forget what you said, something very beautiful. You said, I in one sense construct me in another sense.
Yes.
That was beautifully put, and I think that's a capturing of this idea that you are the character, but you're also the author.
Well, on that note, Josh, we're going to thank you for joining us. It's been a very enlightening conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest has been Joshua Landy. He's a professor of French and Italian at Stanford University. He's co-director of the Literature and Philosophy Initiative at Stanford University.
We also want to thank every one of our literature and library lovers for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, you were a little skeptical about narrative. What are you thinking now with your life as a picaresque?
Well, I'm thinking you and Josh seem like really nice, admirable people, but you're really looking at things in a screwed up way.
How so? Seriously.
Well, I mean, what is this whole life setting? I mean, it's a completely artificial concept. I mean, if you get through life and you don't screw up your children and you don't owe too much money and you haven't hurt anyone, that's a fine life. Now, if there's some war that some creep starts, that might make your life a lot more interesting, but that's too bad. In political philosophy, you're trying to figure out the nature of a state in which most people can have lives that are just plain boring. Why? Because those are wonderful lives.
Well, I grant you that, but I just think it's fundamental. You have to narrate your life. You have to make choices. You've had to stitch together a network of reasons. Otherwise, somebody's going to stitch them together for you, and you're going to be dominated and controlled. And so even if you do it haphazardly without a steady purpose, you do it in sort of as it comes. You know, you believe in just-in-time decision-making.
See, I think you're right about a certain kind of situation where it's very important to be transcendent. You're really affected by the slavery situation. Take Jim in Huckleberry Finn. I mean, he had a narrative of his life where he got away. He went down the river. He got some money. He bought his wife. Then they got together and bought their children. An unrealistic, probably, narrative. But it was a refusal to accept the way he was supposed to be thought of. Okay, that kind of situation, it's terrific.
But you don't think it's the situation of all human beings everywhere?
I think it's just as likely that somebody invents a narrative in which, say, oh, it's just the most important thing in the whole family that this lumberyard has continued for three generations, and if you're not willing to take it over and make you've not just made a bad decision, you've ruined my life, you've ruined the life of people that are already dead. That's what I don't like.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore, I blog.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For a final word, we return to the all-knowing narration of Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, back when I was a whippersnapper, I read that President Kennedy was a fan of James Bond. I worship President Kennedy, so I went to my local charity shop where I found a dog-eared Dr. No, along with a couple of Shel Scott novels and some gold medal originals, including Donald Kehoe's Flying Saucers Are Real. Turns out they're not, by the way. The movie of Dr. No came out right after I read the book. I was disappointed. Where was the giant squid? Not to mention killing Dr. No by burying him in a few tons of guano. How could Hollywood have messed up such a sure thing? Won't be any more James Bond movies, I'll tell you that. Our library was located across the street from my school. I don't know what things are like today, but back then, if you were a young person inside a library, you could not be beaten up. So if I ran there fast enough after the bell, I would be safe for an hour or so. I checked the spine, skull and crossbones marked a mystery, electrons orbiting a nucleus indicated science fiction. Our library had 7 hardcover collections of the Hal Foster Prince Valiant comic strips, back when the stories were actually exciting, with sieges, fights, torture, dragons, and even a giant squid. One day as I entered the library, breathlessly, I saw in the new book section, On Her Majesty's Secret Service, just out in hardcover. I took it to the front desk where the librarian asked me if I perhaps was too young to be reading this sort of book. I became indignant. Is it wrong to want to read the books President Kennedy reads? She relented. It became the first book I ever checked out from the adult section of the library. It was both satisfying and lame. Satisfying in that James Bond was still the snobby sadist I had come to love. But the plot involved Ernst Stavro Blofeld, inspector, brainwashing people in Switzerland so they'd go home to England and poison turkeys. What? Giant squids were shockingly absent. Now, I was alone in my enthusiasm for James Bond. My friends were into war movies and westerns and comic books and Mad Magazine, but Bond was too complicated for them. Bond was mine, my secret hero. As a fantasy figure, however, he was worthless. I could not barrel down powdery slopes in North Dakota. I could not scuba in the Caribbean deeps. I did have a toy Beretta purchased at the Five and Dime in the wake of the movie Dr. No. I would practice a spin and draw in front of a mirror. Occasionally, as well, I would slash the air with sticks in my backyard, dragons for some reason being easier to imagine in the Dakotas than Spectre. I still watch the movies and even reread Dr. No recently after finding a copy in a free box in the street. And true, the James Bond of the books is an insufferable bastard, but if a toy Walter P-38 came on the market, Bond's weapon of choice after the Beretta was taken from him, I would so buy it. Our new literary landscape is littered with fake memoirs, memoirs by people who aren't even 30 yet, tell-all biographies that don't reveal anything, Washington insider shockers that are only bought by Washington insiders to see if their name is in the index, giant squids, again, nowhere. And what if this new world of Kindles and iPads, this world where books are an enemy to be confined in a sleek machine, should all turn out to be another fiendish scheme by Blofeld Inspector to blanket the globe with guano? Well, I have my Beretta, I have my tuxedo, I have my stick. I am ready. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Marion Chatfield Taylor.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Angela Kilduff, Merle Kessler, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Dan Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research. Lale Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our underfunders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And that's a wrap.